far end of the lobby. We have an examination room over there. I've already got some pigs for you. They're already awake. Fewer pigs means less hassle for all of us. All right? The two of them looked at each other. Come on, guys, I said. I just want to get my friend back.
Fine,
one of them said and walked with me into the room.
Well, what are these things?
One of them asked, pointing at the pig-shaped forms.
Yeah, where are the pigs?
The other asked.
Those are the examination tables, I said, moving into the control room. Pigs hate to get picked up, so we just have them lean up against these instead. And they're behind that door there because before they come in, I want to spray some disinfectant in the room. It helps keep infection down. No, you two stay in there. You need to be disinfected too.
We just need skin samples,
one of them said.
I understand, I said. But you break the skin while getting the samples? These pigs are highly susceptible to infection, and then that will spread to the other pigs. I'm already in enough trouble. This will only take a couple of seconds.
Sprinkler-like attachment in the ceiling.
Okay, I said. Here come the pigs.
The two started unzipping their bags to take samples as I slid open the door to let the pigs in. The pigs wandered in, smelled the scent in the air, and got very, very excited. It's fair to say my two friends were surprised at what happened next.
2 minutes or so later, I called Marcus. We have a problem, I said.
What is it?
Marcus said.
I don't know how you told these guys to take samples, but however you told them, the pigs didn't like it, I said,
and then held up the phone so Marcus could hear the screams and squeals.
After a minute of that, I got back on the phone. I could open up the video feed, I said, but I don't think you'd like that.
There was silence on the other end of the phone. Then,
I don't think you appreciate the seriousness of the situation, Marcus said.
It's not my fault, I said. You asked me to help them get genetic samples. I did exactly what you asked. It's your guys who are fucking around here.
Get them out of there, Marcus said to me.
It's not safe, I said truthfully. I think the pigs will eventually wear themselves out, but I'm not going anywhere near them until then.
I still need a sample,
Marcus said after a minute. His ability to write off his two assistants was almost admirable in its way.
I can get you a sample, I said.
I need it from more than one pig, Marcus said.
I can give you samples from as many pigs as you need, I said.
You need to come to me, Marcus said.
I can't do that, I said. The pigs won't exactly follow me.
Considering what just happened, I'm not going to come up to you, Marcus said. And let me remind you, your friend Leah is still with me, and I still have a gun on her.
Okay, I said. I will come to you, but then you'll need to come with me. Give me a minute. I know where we can go to get your samples.
Here, I said, handing Marcus and Leah gas masks and taking one for myself. It's like the sign says, you're going to need this. I fit mine on myself and waited for the other two to fit theirs on.
Come on.
I started walking toward Conduit 2.
Where are we?
Marcus said through his mask.
Why are you doing this, Marcus?
I asked him as we walked out over Conduit 2.
Last week, you talked to me about the problems of a zero-footprint paradise and how we're cutting ourselves off from the rest of the world. But I get the feeling you're not doing this for the good of humanity.
No,
Marcus said.
And why all the talk?
I asked.
I needed to see what was going to work on you,
Marcus said.
Will told me in an email that you got a job here in the Arnold Tower. I had a client who has been very interested in getting the genetics of these pigs for a while now. I saw an opportunity. I knew your mother was pushing for a technology outreach, so if you were of the same mind as her, I might have been able to get you to play along. But it doesn't seem like your thing, so I went with your friend here.
I'll have to thank Will for that, I said.
Oh, he doesn't know, Marcus said. You can't blame him.
Nice of you to treat your brother that way, I said. I could see Marcus shrug briefly.
It's the real world out there, Benjamin. Some places still use money, not energy budgets. I have a living to make.
So all of this, attacking New St. Louis, is just another day on the job?
I said.
we'd reach the access port. I bent down to open it up.
That was going to happen anyway,
Marcus said.
New St. Louis and the other cities are too closed off from everything around them. The people in the wilds were already planning something. I don't care about it one way or the other, really, but it was useful cover for what I needed to do. So I provided the logistics. I borrowed the basic battle plan from a similar action in Detroit a couple years back. They used a fake riot to build an agricultural tower. We're using a real riot to steal from one.
And they signed off on this too, I suppose, I said.
They don't know anything about this, Marcus said. As far as they're concerned, the big event is gathering seeds from the agricultural towers. They're going to sequence those genomes and put them out for everyone to use. Now that's admirable in its way. But my client has other plans for the pig genes.
The access port was fully opened. After you, I said.
I don't think so, Marcus said. After you.
I shrugged and went into the conduit. Marcus kept a bead on Leah as she stepped down the ladder. Finally, he stepped down.
Where the hell are we?
Marcus said again. What does your client want with the pig genes? I asked.
I'm paid not to ask, Marcus said. But I think he wants what the people in the wilds want. The benefit of someone else's work. Having this genome means he has to do a lot less work to make the next set of improvements.
My mom was planning to make this part of the technology outreach, I said. He could have just waited. He didn't have to start all this. You didn't have to start all this.
I don't think my client believes having this genome be open source technology is in anyone's best interest, Marcus said. And personally, I just want to get paid. Now, enough. Give me the samples.
I looked over at Leah. You remember when we were on the roof and I talked about being here? I said.
I do, she said.
I'm sorry you're getting the embargo treatment, I said.
It's all right, Leah said.
Benjamin,
Marcus said. I reached down and flipped open my phone.
My samples, please, Marcus said.
Embargo lifted, I said into the phone. I looked at Marcus as the rumbling started. Here they come now, I said. Leah reached up and pulled the gas mask off Marcus's face just as the first of the samples blew out of the pipes. He caught a load in the face and went down sputtering. Leah and I bolted for the ladder, her first, me following. As I cycled the access port shut, I could see Marcus trying to get a grip on the ladder. I think he might have gotten up the first step before the port sealed shut.
Yeah, the human body's simply not designed to swallow that much pig shit, is what Lou Barnes told me the next day. Nevertheless, Marcus Rosen survived, although not well, and faced with the prospect of a life watching the world go by in a cell, he lawyered up, cut a deal, and brought down some industrialist from the Portland Ecologies, or well, would have, if the fellow hadn't permanently relocated to Turkey. It's my understanding that he's not going to be very happy if he ever steps onto North America again. Will took the fall of his brother badly, and the fact that his brother had betrayed his emails and idol worship even worse. Leah never blamed Will for any of it, but Will blamed himself, and eventually that was the excuse he needed to break up with Leah and leave New St. Louis entirely. He settled in Vancouver eventually, and is doing quite well. He and his wife send holiday cards. The technology outreach program took a hell of a hit in the aftermath of the Battle of New St. Louis. Not in the least because so much of the biotechnology that Mom would have used for outreach flew over the wall in tiny planes. But Mom, who won her election, rolled with the changes. And rather than trying to prosecute those who stole from the agricultural towers, the Executive Council gave them amnesty and open-sourced the genome maps of the plants that were taken, making everyone's lives easier. And after a few decades of sitting behind its wall, New St. Louis is beginning to open up to the wilds and the people there. Well, they're nowhere close to being zero footprint beyond the border, but they're starting, and that's something. After the Battle of New St. Louis, my mother offered to find me a new job if I wanted it.
Her thinking was the man who caught the mastermind behind the attack should be able to get any damn job he wanted, even if he was her son. I thanked her, but I told her no. I still work at Arnold Tower. And more than that, Leah and I were married there, up on the experimental rooftop garden, with Barnes, Jeffers, and Pinter as my groomsmen, Cindy as my best sis, and Lunch as ring bearer. He seemed quite pleased with the job. We were quite pleased to have him. And that's how a pig got into our wedding party. It's a good story, right?
Although I am the editor of Metatropolis, the mayor, as it were, to a very real extent, you could consider Carl Schrader Metatropolis's founding father. He was the one that got the ball rolling by proposing the idea of cities of the future, and he did a whole lot of the heavy conceptual lifting for the project. Not because no one else would do it. Really, thinking up cool ideas was not a problem with this bunch, but because he thought it was fun. And because he had so many cool ideas that sometimes it was all the rest of us could do just to keep up. The guy is really amazing that way. And so it's fitting that his story not only closes out our anthology, but in its way also opens the door for yet another kind of metatropolis, yet another way for societies to create themselves and build and thrive and compete. I'll talk no more about that, since I don't want to spoil the pleasure you'll get from hearing the story. Suffice to say that if your brain hasn't already been blown by now, it's going to get cracked wide open here. And I think you're going to like that sensation. Without further ado, here's Carl Schrader and To Hive from Far Selenia, read by Stefan Rudnicki.
Sixteen plastic-wrapped, frozen reindeer made a forest of jutting legs and antlers in the back of the transport truck. Gennady Malyanov raised his flashlight to peer down the length of the cargo container. He checked his Geiger counter, then said, "It's them, all right." "You're sure?" asked the Swedish cop. Hidden in his rain gear, he was all slick surfaces under the midnight drizzle. The mountain road stretching out behind him shone silver on black, dazzled here and there by the red and blue lights of a dozen emergency vehicles. Gennady climbed down. "Officer, if you think there might be other trucks on this road loaded with radioactive reindeer, I think I need to know." The cop didn't smile. His breath fogged the air. "It's all about jurisdiction," he said. "If they were just smuggling meat. But this is terrorism." "Still," mused Gennady. The cop had been turning away but stopped. Gennady glanced back at the contorted freezer-burned carcasses and shrugged awkwardly. "I never thought I'd get to see them." "See who?" Embarrassed now, Gennady nodded to the truck. "The famous reindeer," he said. "I never thought I'd get to see them." "Spöklik," muttered the cop as he walked away. Gennady glanced in the truck once more, then walked toward his car, shoulders hunched. A little light on its dashboard was flashing, telling him he'd gone over the time he'd booked it for. Traffic on the E-18 had proven heavier than expected, due to the rain and the fact that the police had shut down the whole road at Arjan. He was mentally subtracting the extra car-sharing fees from what they'd pay him for this very short adventure, when someone shouted, "Malyanov!" "What now?" He shielded his eyes with his hand. Two men were walking up the narrow shoulder from the emergency vehicles. Immediately behind them was a van without a flashing light, a big, black and sinister shape that reminded him of some of the paralegal police vans in Ukraine. The men had the burly look of plainclothes policemen. "Are you Gennady Malyanov?" asked the first in English. Rain was beating on his bald skull. Gennady nodded. "You're with the IAEA?" the man went on. "You're an arms inspector." "I've done that," said Gennady neutrally. "Lane Hitchens," said the bald man, sticking out his beefy hand for Gennady to shake. "Interpol." "Is this about the reindeer?" What reindeer? Said Hitchens. Gennady snatched his hand back. This, he said, waving at the checkpoint, the flashing lights, the bowed heads of the suspects in the back of the paddy wagon. You're not here about all this? Hitchens shook his head. Look, I was just told you'd be here, so we came. We need to talk to you. Gennady didn't move. About what? We need your help, damn it. Now come on. Some third person was opening the back of the big van. It still reminded Gennady of an abduction truck, but the prospect of work kept him walking. He needed the cash, even for an hour's consultation at the side of a Swedish road. Hitchens gestured for Gennady to climb into the van. Reindeer? He suddenly said with a grin. You ever heard of the Becquerel reindeer? Said Gennady. No? Well, very famous among us radiation hunters. The transport truck was pinioned in spotlights now as men in hazmat suits walked clumsily toward it. That was serious overkill, of course. Gennady grinned as he watched the spectacle. After Chernobyl, a whole herd of Swedish reindeer got contaminated with cesium-137, he said. 50 times the allowable dose. Tons of reindeer meat had already entered the processing plants before they realized. All those reindeer ended up in a meat locker outside Stockholm where they've been sitting ever since. Cooling off, you know. Well, yesterday somebody broke into the locker and stole some of the carcasses. I think the plan was to get the meat into shops somehow, then cause a big scandal. A sort of dirty bomb effect. The man with Hitchens swore, that's awful. Gennady laughed. And stupid, he said. One look at what's left and nobody in their right mind would buy it. But we caught them anyway, though you know the Norwegian border's only a few kilometers that way. And you tracked them down? Hitchens sounded impressed. Gennady shrugged. He had something of a reputation as an adventurer these days, and it would be embarrassing to admit that he hadn't been brought into this case because of his near-legendary exploits in Pripyat or Azerbaijan. No. The Swedes had tapped Gennady because a couple of years ago he'd spent some time in China shooting radioactive camels. Casually, he said, "This is a paid consultation, right?" Hitchens just nodded at the van again. Gennady sighed and climbed in. At least it was dry in there. The back of the van had benches along its sides, a partition separating it from the cab, and a narrow table down its middle. A surveillance truck, then. A man and a woman were sitting on one bench, so Gennady slid in across from them. His stomach tightened with sudden anxiety. He forced himself to say, "Hello." Meeting anybody new, particularly in a professional capacity, always filled him with an awkward dread. Hitchens and his companion heaved themselves in and slammed the van's doors. Gennady felt somebody climb into the cab and heard its door shut. "My car," said Gennady. Hitchens glanced at the other man. "Jack, could you clear Mr. Malyanov's account? We'll get somebody to return it," he said to Gennady. Then as the van began to move, he turned to the other two passengers. "This is Gennady Malyanov," he said to them. "He's our nuclear expert." "Can you give me some idea what this is all about?" asked Gennady. "Stolen plutonium," said Hitchens blandly. 12 kilos. A bigger deal than your reindeer, huh?" "Reindeer?" said the woman. Gennady smiled at her. She looked a bit out of place in here. She was in her mid-30s, with heavy-framed glasses over her gray eyes and brown hair tightly clawed back on her skull. Her high-collared white blouse was fringed with lace. She looked like the cliché schoolmarm. Around her neck was hung a heavy-looking brass pocket watch. "Gennady, this is Miranda Veen," said Hitchens. Veen nodded. "And this," continued Hitchens, "is Fraction." The man was wedged into one corner of the van. He glanced sidelong at Gennady, but seemed distracted by something else. He was considerably younger than Veen, maybe in his early 20s. He wore glasses similar to hers, but the lenses of his glowed faintly. With a start, Gennady realized they were an augmented reality rig. They were miniature transparent computer screens, and some other scene was being overlaid on top of what he saw through them. Veen's were clear, which meant hers were probably turned off right now. "Miranda's our cultural anthropologist," said Hitchens. You're going to be working with her more than the rest of us. She actually came to us a few weeks ago with a problem of her own. And got no help at all, said Veen, until this other thing came up. A possible connection with the plutonium, said Hitchens, nodding significantly at Fraction. Tell Gennady where you're from, he said to the young man. Fraction nodded and suddenly smiled. Hi, he said, from far Silenia. Gennady squinted at him. His accent had sounded American. Silesia? Asked Gennady. Are you Czech? Miranda Veen shook her head. She was wearing little round earrings, he noticed. Silenia, not Silesia, she said. Silenia is also a woman's name, but in this case it's a place, a nation. Gennady frowned. It is? Where is it? That, said Lane Hitchens, is one of the things we want you to find out. The van headed east to Stockholm. All sorts of obvious questions occurred to Gennady, such as, if you want to know where Silenia is, why don't you just ask Fraction here? But Lane Hitchens seemed uninterested in answering them. Miranda will explain, was all he said. Instead, Hitchens began to talk about the plutonium, which had apparently been stolen many years ago. It kept being sold, Hitchens said with an ironic grimace, and so it kept being smuggled from one place to another. But after the Americans took their hit, everybody started getting better and better detection devices on ports and borders. The plutonium was originally in four big slugs, but the buyers and sellers started dividing it up and moving the pieces separately. They kept selling it as one unit, which is the only reason we can still track it, but it got sliced into smaller and smaller chunks, staying just ahead of the detection technology of the day. We caught Fraction here moving one of them, but he's just a mule and has agreed to cooperate. Buyer who wants to collect them all in one place. They're on the move, but we can now detect a gram hidden in a ton of lead. It's gotten very difficult for the couriers. Gennady nodded, thinking about it. They only had to successfully track one of the packets, of course, to find the buyer. He glanced at Fraction again. The meaning of the man's odd name was obvious now. So buyers are from this mythical Silenia, he said. Hitchens shrugged. Maybe. Then I ask again, why does Fraction here not tell us where that is if he is so cooperative? Or why have those American men who are not supposed to exist not dragged him away to be questioned somewhere? Hitchens laughed dryly. That would not be so easy, he said. Fraction, could you lean forward a bit? The young man obliged. Turn your head, asked Hitchens. Now Gennady could see the earbuds in Fraction's ears. The man sitting across from you is a low-functioning autistic named Danail Gavrilov, said Hitchens. He doesn't speak English. He is, however, extremely good at parroting what he hears, and somebody's trained him to interpret a language of visual and oral cues so he can parrot gestures and motions, even complex ones. Fraction, said Fraction, is not in this van. Gennady's hackles rose. He found himself suddenly reluctant to look into the faintly glowing lenses of Danail Gavrilov's glasses. Cameras in the glasses, he stammered. Of course, yes, and they're mic'd. Can't you trace the signal? He asked Hitchens. The Interpol man shook his head. It goes two or three steps through the normal networks, then jumps into a maze of anonymized botnets. Gennady nodded thoughtfully. He'd seen that kind of thing before and knew how hard it would be to follow the packet streams in and out of Fraction's head. Whoever was riding Danail Gavrilov was, at least for the moment, invulnerable. While they'd been driving, the rain clouds had cleared away, and, visible through the van's back windows, was a pale sky, still near midnight, touched with amber and pink. Do you have any immediate commitments? Asked Hitchens. Gennady eyed him. This is likely to be a long job, I guess. I hope not. We need to find that plutonium. But we don't know how long Fraction will be willing to help us. He could disappear at any moment. So, if you could start tonight... Gennady shrugged. I have no cat to feed, or other people. I'm used to field work, but... He cast about for some disarming joke he could make. I've never before had an anthropologist watching me work. Veen drummed her fingers on the narrow tabletop. I don't mean to be impolite, she said. But you have to understand. I'm not here for your plutonium. I admit its importance, she added quickly, holding up one hand. I just think you should know I'm after something else. He shrugged. Okay, what? My son. Gennady stared at her, and at a loss for what to say, finally just shrugged and smiled. Veen started to talk, but at that point the van rolled to a stop outside one of the better hotels in Stockholm. The rest of the night consisted of a lot of running around and arrangement making, as Gennady was run across town to collect his bags from his own modest lodgings. They put him up on the same floor as Veen and Hitchens, though where Fraction stayed or whether he even slept, Gennady didn't know. Gennady was too agitated to sleep, so he spent a long time surfing the net, trying to find references to his reindeer and the incident on the road that evening. So far there was nothing, and eventually he grew truly tired and slept. Hitchens knocked on Gennady's door at 8 o'clock. He, Veen, and Fraction were tucking into a fine breakfast in the suite across the hall. Fraction looked up as Gennady entered. Good morning, he said. I trust you slept well. The American term creeped out came to Gennady's mind as he mumbled some platitude in reply. Fraction smiled, except, of course, it was Daniil Gavrilov doing the actual smiling. Gennady wondered whether he took any notice at all of the social interactions going on around him, or whether he'd merely discovered that following his rider's commands was the easiest way to navigate the bewildering complexities of human society. Before going to sleep last night, Gennady had looked up Fraction's arrangement with Gavrilov. Gavrilov was something Stanley Milgram had dubbed a Cyrenoid after Cyrano de Bergerac. He was much more than a puppet, and much less than an actor. Whatever he was clearly enjoying his eggs Benedict. What are we doing today? Gennady asked Hitchens. We're going to start as soon as you've eaten and freshened up. Gennady frowned at Veen. Start? Where is it that we start? Veen and Hitchens exchanged a look. Fraction smiled. Had somebody in some other time zone just commanded him to do that? Gennady wasn't in the best of moods, since he kept expecting to remember some detail from last night that made sense of everything. Though the coffee was kicking in, nothing was coming to him. Plus, he was itching to check the news, in case they were talking about his reindeer. Miranda suddenly said, Hitchens has told you about his problem. Maybe it's time I told you about mine. She reached into a bag at her feet and dropped an e-book on the table. This was of the quarto type, with 300 pages of flexible e-paper, each of which could take the impressions of whatever pages you wanted. As she flipped through it, Gennady could see that she had filled its pages with handwritten notes, photos, and web pages, all of which bled off the edges of the e-paper. At any readable scale, the virtual pages were much bigger than the physical window you looked at them through. A fact she demonstrated as she flipped to one page and, dragging her fingers across it, shoved its news articles off into limbo. Words and pictures rolled by until she planted her finger again to stop the motion. Here, she held out the book to Gennady. Centered in the page was the familiar format of an email. Mom, it said, I know you warned me against leaving the protection of Cascadia, but Europe's so amazing. Everywhere I've been, they've respected our citizenship, and you know I love the countryside. I've met a lot of people who are fascinated with how I grew up. Gennady looked up. You're from the cities? She nodded. Whatever Miranda Veen's original nationality, she had adopted citizenship in a pan-global urban network whose cities were, taken together, more powerful than the nations where they were situated. Her son might have been born somewhere in the Vancouver-Portland-Seattle corridor, now known simply as Cascadia, or in Shanghai. It didn't matter. He'd grown up with the right to walk and live in either megacity, and in many others, with equal ease. But the email suggested that his mother had neglected to register his birth in any of the nations that the cities were supposedly a part of. Gennady read a little further. Anyway, it said, I met this guy yesterday, a backpacker, calls himself Dodger. He said he had no citizenship other than the ARG he's part of. I went, sure, yeah, whatever, so he mailed me a path link. I've been following it around Rome, and, well, it's amazing so far. Here's some shots. Following were a number of fairly mundane images of old Roman streets. Gennady looked up, puzzled. Alternate reality games, ARGs, were as common as mud. Millions of kids around the world put virtual overlays and geographical positioning information over the real planet and made up complicated games involving travel and the specific features of locale. Internet citizenship wasn't new either. A growing subset of the population considered themselves dual citizens of some real nation, plus an online virtual world. Since the economies of virtual nations could be bigger than many real-world countries, such citizenship wasn't just an affectation. It could be more economically important than your official nationality. It wasn't a big step to imagining an ARG-based nationality. So Gennady said, "I don't see what's significant here." "Read the next message," said Veen. She sat back, chewing a fingernail, and watched him as he read the next in what looked like a string of emails pasted into the page. "Mom, weren't those remappings amazing? Oversatch is so incredibly vibrant compared to the real world. Even Hong Kong's overlays don't cut it next to that, and the participatory stuff is really intense. I walked away from it today with over 10,000 Satchmos in my wallet. Sure, it's only convertible through this one anonymous portal based out of Bulgaria, but it is convertible. Worth something like $500, I think, if I was stupid enough to cash it in that way. It's worth a lot more if I keep it in the ARG. Veen leaned over to scroll the paragraphs past. "This one," she said. "2 weeks later." Gennady read, "It 2.0 is this overlay that remaps everything in real time into Oversatch terms. It's pretty amazing when you learn what's really happening in the world. How the Synodica is causing all these pressures on Europe. Synodica manifests in all sorts of ways. Just imagine what a self-organizing catastrophe would look like. And Oversatch turns out to be just a gateway into the remappings that oppose Synodica. There's others. Trapton, Aligor, and Silenia." "Silenia," said Gennady. Fraction sat up to look at the book. He nodded and said, "Oversatch is a gateway to Silenia." "And you?" Gennady asked him. "You've been there?" Fraction smiled. "I lived there." Gennady was bewildered. Some of the words were familiar. He was vaguely familiar with the concept of geographical overlays, for instance. But the rest of it made no sense at all. "What's Synodica?" he asked Fraction. Fraction's smile was maddeningly smug. "You have no language for it," he said. "You'd have to speak it 2.0. But Synodica is what's really going on here." Gennady sent an appealing look to Lane Hitchens. Hitchens grunted. "Synodica may be the organization behind the plutonium thefts," he said. "Synodica is not an organization," said Fraction, "any more than it 2.0 is just a word." "Whatever," said Lane. "Gennady, you need to find them. Miranda will help because she wants to find her son." Gennady struggled to keep up. "And Synodica," he said, "is in Far Silenia." Fraction laughed contemptuously. Veen darted him an annoyed look and said to Gennady, "It's not that simple. Here, read the last message." She dragged it up from the bottom of the page. "Mom, Silenia is a new kind of it, but so is Synodica. A terrifying thought. Without that it, without the word and the act of pointing that it represents, you cannot speak of these things. You can't even see them. I watch them now day by day. The walking cities. The countries that appear like cicadas to walk there one day in the sun only to vanish again at dusk. I can't be an observer anymore. I can't be me anymore, or Synodica will win. I'm sorry, Mom. I have to become something that can be pointed at by 2.0. Silenia needs me, or as many me's as I can spare. I'll call you." Gennady read the message again, then once more. "It makes no sense," he said. "It's a jumble, but..." He looked to Hitchens. "It 2.0. It's not a code, is it?" Hitchens shook his head. He handed Gennady a pair of heavy-framed glasses like Veen's. Gennady recognized the brand name on the arms, Ariadne AR, the Swiss augmented reality firm that had recently bought out Google. Veen also wore Ariadne's, but there was no logo at all on Fraction's glasses. Gennady gingerly put them on and pressed the frames to activate them. Instantly, a cool blue transparent sphere appeared in the air about 2 feet in front of him. The glasses were projecting the globe straight onto his retinas, of course. Orbiting around it were various icons and command words that only he could see. Gennady was familiar with this sort of interface. All he had to do was focus his gaze on a particular command and it would change color. Then he could blink to activate it, or dismiss it by looking somewhere else. "Standard software," he mumbled as he scanned through the icons. "Geographical services, wikis, social nets. What's this?" Hitchens and Veen had put on their own glasses, so Gennady made the unfamiliar icon visible to all of them and picked it out of the air with his fingers. He couldn't feel it, of course, but was able to set the little stylized R in the center of the table where they could all look at it. Danail Gavrilov nodded, mimicking a satisfied smile for whoever was riding him. "That's your first stop," he said. "A little place called Rivet Couture." Hitchens excused himself and left. Gennady barely noticed. He'd activated the icon for Rivet Couture and was listening to a lecture given by a bodacious young woman who didn't really exist. He'd moved her so she appeared to be standing in the middle of the room, but Miranda Veen kept walking through her. The pretty woman was known as a Serling. She was a kind of narrator, and right now she was bringing Gennady up to speed on the details of an alternate reality game called Rivet Couture. While she talked, the cameras and positional sensors in Gennady's glasses had been working overtime to figure out where he was and what objects were around him. So while the Serling explained that Rivet Couture was set in a faux gaslight era, an 1880 that never existed, all the stuff in the room mutated. The walls adopted a translucent, glowing layer of floral wallpaper. The lamp sconces faded behind ghostly brass gas fixtures. Miranda Veen walked through the Serling again, and for a second Gennady thought the game had done an overlay on her as well. In fact, her high-necked blouse and long skirt suddenly seemed appropriate. With a start, he saw that her earrings were actually little gears. "Steampunk's out of style, isn't it?" he said. Veen turned, reaching up to touch her earlobes. She smiled at him, and it was the first genuine smile he'd seen from her. "My parents were into New Age stuff," she said. "I rebelled by joining a steam gang. We wore crinoline and tight waistcoats, and I used to do my hair up in an elaborate bun with long pins. The boys wore pince-nez and paisley vests, that sort of thing. I drifted away from the culture a long time ago, but I still loved the style." Gennady found himself grinning at her. He understood that, the urge to step just slightly out from the rest of society. Pocket watch Veen wore like a necklace was a talisman of sorts, a constant reminder of who she was and how she was unique. But while Miranda Veen's talisman might be a thing of gears and armatures, Gennady's were places. Instead of an icon of brass and gears, he wore memories of dripping concrete halls and the shadowed calandria of ruined reactors, of blue glowing pools packed with spent fuel rods, of an unlit commercial freezer where an entire herd of irradiated reindeer lay jumbled like toys. Rivet Couture was not so strange. Many women wore lingerie under their conservative work clothes to achieve the same effect. For those people without such an outlet, overlays like Rivet Couture gave them much the same sense of owning a secret uniqueness. Kids walked alone in the ordinary streets of Berlin or Minneapolis, yet at the same moment they walked side by side through the misty cobblestone streets of a Victorian Atlantis. Many of them spent their spare time filling in the details of the places, designing the clothes and working out the history of Rivet Couture. It was much more than a game, and it was worldwide. Miranda Veen rolled her bags to the door, and Fraction opened it for her. They turned to Gennady, who was still sitting at the devastation of the breakfast table. "Are you ready?" said Miranda. "I'm coming," he said. He stood up and stepped from Stockholm into Atlantis. Rivet Couture had a charmingly light hand. It usually added just a touch or two to what you were seeing or hearing, enough to provide a whiff of strangeness to otherwise normal places. In the elevator, Gennady's glasses filtered the glare of the fluorescence until it resembled candlelight. At the front desk, an ornate scroll-worked cash register wavered into visibility over the terminal the clerk was using. Outside, in the street, Gennady heard the nicker of nearby horses and saw black-maned heads toss somewhere out in the fast-moving stream of electric cars. Stockholm was already a mix of classical grandeur and high modernism. These places had really been gaslit once, and many streets were still cobbled, particularly outside such romantic landmarks as the King's Palace. Réveil-Couture didn't have to work very hard to achieve its effects, especially when the brilliant, star-like shapes of other players began appearing. You could see them kilometers away, even through buildings and hills, which made it easy to rendezvous with them. RC forbade certain kinds of contact. There were no telephones in this game. But it wasn't long before Gennady, Miranda, and Fraction were sitting in a cafe with two other longtime players. Gennady let Miranda lead, and she enthusiastically plunged into a discussion of RC politics and history. She'd clearly been here before, and it couldn't have just been her need to find her son that propelled her to learn all this detail. He watched her wave her hands while she talked, and her lucibular and coffee grew cold. Agata and Pear warmed quickly to Miranda, but were a bit more reserved with Gennady. That was fine by him, since he was experiencing his usual tongue tanglement around strangers. So, listening, he learned a few things. Réveil-Couture's Atlantis was a global city. Parts of it were everywhere. But their location shifted and moved depending on the actions of the players. You could change your overlay to that of another neighborhood, but in so doing you lost the one you were in. This was generally no problem, although it meant that other players might blink in and out of existence as you moved. The game was free. This was a bit of a surprise, but not a huge one. There were plenty of open-source games out there, but few had the detail and beautiful sophistication of this one. Gennady had assumed there was a lot of money behind it, but in fact there was something just as good. The attention of a very large number of fans. Influence within Atlantean society. RC was a game of politics, and most of its moves happened in conversation. As games went, its most ancient ancestor was probably a 20th century board game called Diplomacy. Gennady mentioned this idea, and Pear smiled. "The board game, yes," said Pear. "But more like play-by-mail versions like Slobovia, where you had to write a short story for every move you made in the game. Like the characters in Slobovian stories, we are diplomats, courtesans, pickpockets, and cabinet ministers. All corrupt, of course," he added with another smile. "And we often prey on newbies," Agata added with a leer. "Ah, yes," said Pear, as if reminded of something. "We will proceed to do that now. As disgraced Interior Minister Puddleglum Fudthucker, I have many enemies, and most of my compatriots are being watched. You must take this diplomatic pouch to one of my co-conspirators. If you get waylaid and killed on the way, it's not my problem. But make sure you discard the pouch at the first sign of trouble." "Hmm," said Gennady, as Pear handed him a felt-wrapped package about the size of a file folder. "What would the first sign of trouble look like?" Pear glanced at Agata, who pursed her lips and frowned at the ceiling. "Oh, say, strangers converging on you or moving to block your path?" Pear leaned forward. "If you do this," he whispered, "the rewards could be great down the line. I have powerful friends, and when I am back in my rightful portfolio, I will be in a position to advance your own career." Pear had to go to work, in the real world. So they parted ways, and Gennady's group took the Blue Line Metro to Radhusit Station, which was already a subterranean fantasy, and in Réveil-Couture became a candle-lit cavern full of shadowy strangers in cowled robes. Up on the surface, they quickly located a stuffy-looking brokerage on a narrow side street, where the receptionist happily took the package from Gennady. She was dressed in a Chanel suit, but a tall feather was poking up from behind her desk, and at Gennady's curious glance, she reached down to show him her ornate Victorian tea hat. Out in the street, he said, "Cosplay seems to be an important part of the game. I'm not dressed for it." Miranda laughed. "In that suit,
You're nearly there. You just need a fob watch and the vest. You'll be fine. As to you, she turned to Fraction. I have many costumes, said the Cyrenoid. I shall retrieve one and meet you back at the hotel. He started to walk away. But wait. Gennady started after him, but Miranda put a hand on his arm. She shook her head. He comes and goes, she said. There's nothing we can do about it, though I assume Hitchens' people have him under surveillance. It probably does them no good. I'm sure the places Fraction goes are all virtual. Gennady watched the Cyrenoid vanish into the mouth of the metro station. He'd also disappeared from Reveille Couture. Unhappily, Gennady said, Let's disappear ourselves for a while. I'd like to check on my reindeer. You may, said Miranda coolly, but I am staying here. I am looking for my son, Mr. Malyanov. This is not just a game to me. Neither were the reindeer. As it turned out, he didn't have to leave RC to surf for today's headlines. There was indeed plenty of news about a crackpot terrorist ring being busted, but nothing about the individual agents who'd done the fieldwork. This was fine by Gennady, who'd been briefly famous after stopping an attempt to blow up the Chernobyl sarcophagus some years before. He'd taken that assignment in the first place because in the abandoned streets of Pripyat he could be utterly alone. Being interviewed for TV and then recognized on the street had been intensely painful for him. They shopped for some appropriately steampunk styles for Gennady to wear. He hated shopping with a passion and was self-conscious with the result, but Miranda seemed to like it. They met a few more denizens of Atlantis through the afternoon, but he still hung back. And at dinner she asked him whether he'd ever done any role-playing. Gennady barked a laugh. I do it all the time. He rattled off half a dozen of the more popular online worlds. He had multiple avatars in each, and in one of them he'd been cultivating his character for over a decade. Miranda was puzzled at his awkwardness, so finally Gennady explained that those games allowed him to stay at home and let a virtual avatar do the roving. He had many different bodies and played as both genders. But an avatar-to-avatar conversation was nothing like a face-to-face conversation in reality, even an alternate reality like Reveille Couture's. Nowadays they call it social phobia, he said with reluctance. But really, I'm just shy. Miranda's response was a surprised, Oh. There was a long silence after that, while she thought and he squirmed in his seat. Would you be more comfortable doubling up? She asked at last. What do you mean? Riding me Cyrenoid-wise, the way that Fraction rides Danael. Except, she added wryly, it would only be during game interactions. I'm fine, he said irritably. I'll get into it, you'll see. It's just, I expected to be home in my own apartment right now. I wasn't expecting a new job away from home with an indefinite duration and no idea where I'll be going. I'm not even sure how to investigate. What am I investigating? Who? None of this is normal to me. It's going to take a bit of an adjustment. He resented that she thought of him as some kind of social cripple who had to be accommodated. He had a job to do, and better than almost anybody, he knew what was at stake. For the vast majority of people, plutonium was just a word, no more real than the word vampire. Few had held it. Few had seen its effects. Gennady knew it, its color, its heft, and the uses you could put it to. Gennady wasn't going to let his own frailties keep him from finding the stuff, because the mere fact that somebody wanted it was a catastrophe. If he didn't find the plutonium, Gennady would spend his days waiting, expecting every morning to turn on the news and hear about which city and how many millions of lives had finally met it. That night he lay in bed for hours, mind restless, trying to relate the terms of this stylish game to the very hard-nosed smuggling operation he had to crack. Reveille Couture functioned a bit like a secret society, he decided. That first interaction, when he'd carried a pretend diplomatic pouch between two other players, suggested a physical mechanism for the transfer of the plutonium. When he talked to Hitchens about it after supper, the Interpol agent had confirmed it. We're pretty sure that organized crime has started using games like yours to move stuff. Drugs, for instance. You can use two completely unrelated strangers as mules for pickups and handoffs, even establish long chains of them. Each hop can be a few kilometers, by foot even, avoiding all our detection gear. One player can throw a package over his country's border and another find it by its GPS coordinates later. It's a nightmare. Yet Rivet Couture was itself just a gateway, a milestone on the way to far Silenia. Between Rivet Couture and Silenia was the place from where Miranda's son had sent most of his emails. Oversatch, he'd called it. If Rivet Couture was like a secret society operating within normal culture, then Oversatch was like a second-order secret society, one that existed only within the culture of Rivet Couture, a conspiracy inside a conspiracy. Hitchens had admitted that he hated alternate reality games. They destroy all the security structures we put in place so carefully since 9/11. Just destroy them. It's 'cause you're not you anymore. Hell, you can have multiple people playing one character in these games, handing them off to one another in shifts. Geography doesn't matter. Identity is a joke. Everybody on the planet is like Fraction. How can you find a conspiracy in that? Gennady explained this insight to Miranda the next morning, and she nodded soberly. You're half right, she said. Only half? There's so much more going on here, she said. If you're game for the game today, maybe we can see some of it. He was. Dressed as he was, Gennady could hide inside the interface his glasses gave him. He'd decided to use these factors as a wall between him and the other avatars. He'd pretend out in the open, as he so often did from the safety of his room. Anyway, he'd try. And they did well that day. Miranda had been playing the game for some weeks with a fanatical single-mindedness born of her need to find her son. Gennady found that if he thought in terms of striking up conversations with strangers on the street, then he'd be paralyzed and couldn't play. But if he pretended it was his character, Sir Arthur Toll, who was doing the talking, then his years of gaming experience quickly took over. Between the two of them, he and Miranda quickly developed a network of contacts and responsibilities. They saw Fraction every day or two, and what was interesting was that Gennady found himself quickly falling into the same pattern with the Serenoid that he had with Lane Hitchens. They would meet, Gennady would give a report, and the other would nod in satisfaction. Hitchens's people had caught Fraction carrying one of the plutonium pieces. That was almost everything that Gennady knew about the Serenoid, and nearly all that Hitchens claimed to know as well. There's one thing we have figured out, Hitchens had added when Gennady pressed. It's his accent. Daniil Gavrilov doesn't speak English. He's Bulgarian. But he's parroting English perfectly, right down to the accent. And it's an American accent, specifically West Coast, Washington State or thereabouts. Well, that's something to go on, said Gennady. Yes, said Hitchens unhappily, but not much. Gennady knew what Hitchens had hired him to do, and he was working at it. But increasingly, he wondered whether in some way he didn't understand, he had also been hired by Fraction, or maybe the whole of the IAEA had. The thought was disturbing, but he didn't voice it to Hitchens. It seemed too crazy to talk about. The insight Miranda was promising didn't come that first day or the next. It took nearly a week of hard work before Puddleglum Fudthucker met them for afternoon tea and gave a handwritten note to Miranda. This is today's location of the Griffin Rampant, he said. The food is excellent, and the conversation particularly profitable. When Puddleglum disappeared around the corner, Miranda hoisted the note and yelled in triumph. Gennady watched her, bemused. I'm so good, she told him. Hitchens's boys never got near this place. What is it? He thought of bomb makers' warehouses, drug ops maybe. But she said, it's a restaurant. Oh, but it's an Atlantean restaurant, she added when she saw the look on his face. The food comes from Atlantis. It's cooked there. Only Atlanteans eat it. Sociologically, this is a big break. She explained that any human society had membership costs, and the currency was commitment. To demonstrate commitment to some religions, for instance, people had to undergo ordeals, or renounce all their worldly goods, or leave their families, They had to live according to strict rules. And the stricter the rules, and the more of them there were, the more stable the society.
That's crazy, said Gennady. You mean the less freedom people have, the happier they are?
Miranda shrugged. You trade some sources of happiness that you value less for one big one that you value more. Anyway, the point is, leveling up in a game like Rive Couture represents commitment. We've leveled up to the point where the griffin is open to us.
He squinted at her. And that is important because...
Because Fraction told me that the griffin is a gateway to Oversatch.
They retired to the hotel to change. Formal clothing was required for a visit to the griffin. And so, for the first time, Gennady found himself donning the complete Rive Couture regalia. It was pure steampunk. Miranda had bought him a tight, pinstriped suit, whose black silk vest had a subtle dragon pattern sewn into it. He wore two belts, an ordinary one and a leather utility belt that hung down over one hip and had numerous loops and pouches on it. She'd found a bowler hat and had ordered him to slick back his hair when he wore it. When he emerged, hugely self-conscious, he found Miranda waiting in what appeared to be a cast-iron corset and long black skirt. Heavy black boots peeked out from under the skirt. She twirled an antique-looking parasol and grinned at him.
Every inch the Russian gentleman, she said.
Ukrainian, he reminded her. And they set off for the griffin rampant. Gennady's glasses had tuned themselves to filter out all characteristic frequencies of electric light. His earbuds likewise eliminated the growl and jangle of normal city noises, replacing them with Atlantean equivalents. He and Miranda sauntered through a city transformed. And there seemed no hurry tonight, as the gentle amber glow of the streetlights, distant nicker of horses, and pervasive sound of crickets were quite relaxing. They turned a corner and found themselves outside the Griffin, which was an outdoor cafe that filled a side street. Lifting his glasses for a second, Gennady saw that the place was actually an alley between two glass and steel skyscrapers. But in Rive Couture, the buildings were shadowy stone monstrosities festooned with gargoyles, and there were plenty of virtual trees to hide the sky. In ordinary reality, the cafe was hidden from the street by tall fabric screens. In the game, these were stone walls, and there was an ornately carved griffin over the entrance. Paper lanterns lit the tables. A dapper waiter with a sly expression led Gennady and Miranda to a table, where, to the surprise of neither, Fraction was lounging. The Cyrenoid was drinking mineral water, swirling it in his glass in imitation of the couple at the next table. "Welcome to Atlantis," said Fraction, as Gennady unfolded his napkin. Gennady nodded. He did feel transported somehow, as though this really was some parallel world and not a downtown alley. The waiter came by and recited the evening specials. He left menus, and when Gennady opened his, he discovered that the prices were all in the game's pretend currency, Atlantean dinars. He leaned over to Miranda.
"The game's free," he murmured. "So who pays for all this?"
Fraction had overheard and barked a laugh. "I said welcome to Atlantis. We have our own economy, just like Sweden." Gennady shook his head. He'd been studying the game and knew that there was no exchange that translated dinars into any real-world currency.
"I mean, who pays for the meat, the vegetables, the wine?"
"It's all Atlantean," said Fraction. "If you want to earn some real social capital here, I can introduce you to some of the people who raise it."
Miranda shook her head. "We want to get to the next level, to Oversatch," she said. "You know that. Why haven't you taken us straight there?"
Fraction shrugged. "Tried that with Hitchens's men. They weren't able to get there."
"Oversatch is like an ARG inside Rive Couture," Gennady guessed. "So you have to know the rules and people and settings of RC before you can play the meta game."
"That's part of it," admitted Fraction. "But Rive Couture is just an overlay, a map drawn on a map. Oversatch is a whole new map."
"I don't understand."
"I'll show you." The waiter came by and they ordered. Then Fraction stood up. "Come, There's a little store at the back of the restaurant. Gennady followed him. Behind a screen of plants were several market stall-type tables, piled with various merchandise. There was a lot of clothing in Atlantean styles, which all appeared to be handmade. There were also various trinkets, such as fob watches and earrings similar to Miranda's. "Ah, here," said Fraction, drawing Gennady to a table at the very back. He held up a pair of round, antique-looking glasses. "Try them on." Gennady did, and as his eyes adjusted, he saw the familiar glow of an augmented reality interface booting up. "These are..." "Like the ones you were wearing," nodded Fraction, "but with some additions. They're made entirely in 3D printers and by hand, by and for the people of Oversatch and some of their Atlantean friends."